You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky. Businesses have had to be flexible this year, from working remotely to pivoting their business models for long-term survival and growth. For example, restaurants are moving their dining outdoors and adding takeout and catering. If you're in charge of hiring for your business, these pivots have made your job even more challenging, especially if you have to hire for brand new roles. Thankfully, there's one place that you can always count on to make hiring faster and easier. ZipRecruiter.com/murder. When you post a job on ZipRecruiter, it gets sent to over 100 top job boards with one click. Then ZipRecruiter's powerful technology finds people with the right skills and experience for your job and actively invites them to apply. It's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See for yourself. Right now, you can try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/murder. That's ZipRecruiter.com/M-U-R-D-E-R. Let ZipRecruiter take hiring off your plate so you can focus on growing your business. Go to ZipRecruiter.com/murder. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good evening. A husband, a father, a killer. Chris Watts was a family man. Everybody, including his family, believed that. Yet on August 13, 2018, he murdered Shannan, his pregnant wife, and 2 young daughters, burying Shannan and their unborn son in a shallow grave and dumping their daughters' bodies in separate oil tanks. As terrible as his story is, it is also a warning because, to this day, living behind bars, Watts is still acting out the character traits that made him kill in the first place. In this, the first and only psychological exploration of the Watts family murders, psychotherapist Lena Durhalley has pieced together the crime, the events leading to it, and most of all, her beliefs about the why, including the fact that Chris Watts, now a self-described man of God, is not in the least remorseful about killing his family. Using police discovery and other sources, Durhalley recreates the night of the murders and the investigation that followed. She explores the childhoods, families of origin, meeting and early relationships of Shannan and Chris Watts. She also examines Watts' double life and duplicity regarding his well-publicized affair with a co-worker, who, although she claimed their affair was casual, was searching online for wedding dresses at the time of the murders. The book includes an in-depth look at community psychopaths, the different subtypes of narcissism, how to prevent this type of violence, and interviews with a neuroscientist, a criminal psychologist, and a journalist in order to determine what in Watts' twisted makeup allowed him to hide who he really is for so long. Using her knowledge of attachment theory, imago relationship theory, and psychopathology, Durhalley draws a profile of the real Chris Watts, and just as important, she warns readers that he is still a danger today. The book we're featuring this evening is My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer, with my special guest, psychotherapist and author, Lena Durhalley. Welcome to the program, and thank you so much for this interview, Lena Durhalley.
Thank you so much, Dan. I'm happy to be with you today.
Thank you so much. I know myself and so many other people were looking forward to this interview with you today. This is an incredible book. Let's start right away with what was the objective for writing this book in the first place?
Oh, gosh. There were so many objectives, actually, especially now as I look back. You know, when you write something like this, you completely submerge yourself in it, and I don't think you can really see clearly until you have the hindsight and I actually released the book exactly a year ago now. So I've had a year to kind of look back and really reflect on the several objectives. I think one was, I hear sometimes that people say motive doesn't matter and things like this. And I work with a lot of people, and especially women, that have suffered this type of narcissistic abuse, and not a lot of people know how to label it or know what to look for. And so, one, you know, I wanted this book to be an education. I didn't want to write some sensationalized crime story because, you know, the people I'm talking about, they're real people, and so many people in this case have been so deeply affected, including law enforcement. One of the head detectives on the case actually retired because of his PTSD from the case. And so, you know, we really want to think that these are real people, and so many people's lives were destroyed because of Chris Watts's actions. And I think it's really important that people sort of know, you know, what type of patterns there are to look for. And arguably, you know, we'll probably talk about this at some point, I don't really think Chris Watts displayed any warning signs, which was sort of the second objective of the book, because as someone, you know, who I'm a psychotherapist, I have worked with a lot of couples. I see a lot of couple dynamics. I've worked with personality disorders before. And Chris Watts just really didn't fit this typical picture of, you know, what we see when we see a family annihilator. Some of his features do, but mostly he was this really passive, deferential, low-key guy who was so easygoing and go with the flow, and he showed no signs of being controlling or anything like that. And I think that was one of the reasons people were so drawn to this case. Everybody was just scratching their heads and puzzled about, well, how does somebody who has the opposite signs of somebody who normally would kill his wife or family, how does this happen? And so those were sort of the main objectives of helping people understand. And I learned so much writing this book as well. So it helped me understand more. And, you know, to also give people an education and sort of look at, again, the neuroscience. I really liked talking to the neuroscientist I interviewed for this book. I interviewed a great criminal psychologist for this book. So I really wanted to help people understand, and I really wanted people to learn. And then I think the third objective was I wanted to go on the record as a mental health professional to defend Shanann Watts. If people watched the Netflix documentary about this case, which is called American Murder, they go into this aspect of the case that there was a lot of victim blaming going on about Shanann sort of, you know, being the person, you know, there's some narrative that she somehow pushed Chris to do this, and I could not disagree with that more. And so I wanted to go on the record as a professional defending her, because she can't defend herself. And so it was really important for me to do that for her. And so those were my main objectives.
Now, what is it that you observed that drew you into this case immediately and, as you say, obsessed you afterwards?
Yeah, you know, the first time I saw anything about this case was this Chris Watts interview on his porch. So after his wife and children are reported missing, he agrees to do an interview, a television interview with the news on his front porch. And the way he's talking about his family and children is just so removed and so detached. His eyes look really soulless, but at the same time, you see this, you know, handsome, tan, muscular guy in front of this large suburban home. And it just, there's just this real incongruency about it, this, you know, picture perfect, idyllic life. And then this man who on the surface seems great, but you can tell that there's something, you know, not right. And then as the story unfolded, you know, merely days after he did that interview, he failed a polygraph test and ended up confessing. His first confession, he blamed his wife and said, you know, she killed the kids, and then he killed her in a fit of rage. But as forensic evidence came out, and eventually he signed off on a confession that he had killed all three of them, but just the, you know, burying his pregnant wife in the shallow grave face down, which he in certain confessions has confessed that he did it on purpose, the way he just kind of threw her callously into that grave. And then putting his children in oil tanks. I mean, this aspect just blows the mind of everyone. How could a father put his baby girl, 3 and 4 years old, in oil tanks? I mean, it, just that horrific aspect, and again, of this person who had no warning signs, no criminal record, no history of abuse, no history of being controlling, anything of that sort. Everybody loved him. As you know, I researched the book. You could not find one person who had anything bad to say about this man.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was, you know, obsessed with the same reason everybody else was. How does this happen? How does somebody so seemingly normal and like a nice guy do something that is the epitome of evil?
Certainly. It's worth mentioning, obviously, about August 13, 2018. And you write that Nicky Atkinson is a hero in this story, and does incredible pressures put on Chris Watts. But as we discuss this case further, I think the audience will see and realize that without her actions initially, there might have been more for Chris Watts to be able to do, to be able to cover his tracks. We'll talk about about that and a motivation for that. But let's talk about, again, you talk about the senselessness of this, and especially it's profound in terms of his, everybody saying what a great guy he was, and all of his actions and behavior, and his wife's respect and love for him, and her posts about their love and their, and everybody's idea that this was an idyllic relationship in the first place. Let's talk about the relationship where he works at this petroleum company, and as an impetus for and a reason for these murders to occur in the first place.
Yeah, so, you know, Shanann and Chris were together for about 8 years before he murdered the family, and they were married for 6. And, you know, up until she had traveled to North Carolina, so she took her daughters, Bella and Cece, to North Carolina for the summer. They spent about 5 weeks there visiting Chris's family and Shanann's family, and Chris joined them for the last week of the trip, but he was by himself in Colorado, where they lived for 5 weeks, and he was working. And, you know, right before Shanann and the girls left for North Carolina, Chris had struck up a flirtation with a coworker named Nicole Kessinger. So he met her, you know, he was out in the field a lot, but there were times once or twice a week where they would have to go into the office. And so he would see her there, kind of like a water cooler thing. And I think they found each other attractive. But what ended up happening was he was already texting and flirting with Nicole Kessinger. Even he was on a business trip with Shanann for the supplements she promoted called Thrive in San Diego right before she took the girls to North Carolina. And even on that trip where he was with Shanann on a weekend, just the two of them, he was already flirting with Nicole Kessinger. But when the family left for 5 weeks, all of a sudden he had this opportunity to have this bachelor life, and he was, you know, he went full force into this affair with Nicole Kessinger and basically spent, you know, 5 days a week with her for pretty much the entirety of the time his family was gone. So if you look at one of the, you know, I always like to say about this case, I call it the perfect storm of multiple factors that came together. So, you know, This affair seemed to be one of the driving forces behind what he did. But, you know, as we'll go into later, what I like to tell people is that lots of people have affairs. I deal with infidelity in my practice all the time. Most people who have affairs do not kill their family. So we know that the affair was not the reason why he killed his family. There had to be something much deeper, much more wrong than just an affair. But that was one of the catalysts that put this idea in motion for him to premeditate the killings of his family.
Now, unlike many times where there seems to be a pressure from this a new affair or a denigration of, say, the wife and sort of a competition between them, it almost seemed, at least, that there was almost the opposite going on in terms of her speaking to Chris about his family and his desire to leave that family. If you could explain.
Yeah, about Nicole's, how she approached it. I don't think we'll ever really know the full story about what Chris told Nicole Kessinger about his family. He says, that maybe he told her that he was leaving them, but then he said that he knew that she was married when he met her. He was wearing his wedding ring. And she says, that on the record that she told him, like, go fix things with your wife. I don't want to be the second fiddle. Like, you need to figure that out first. But, there's also times where Nicole Kessinger would say things to him, like she wanted to give him his first son. And Shanann was pregnant with the third child, and she was actually pregnant with a boy. And so, Chris said in one of his confessions, and I looked at multiple confessions that he's given, and he has changed the story. He has said that when Nicole said that she wanted to give him his first son, that was when the idea of plotting these murders came into his head. So, I'm not sure exactly what was said behind the scenes, because there seems to be some conflicting, contradictory things that both of them say about, how much she knew about his marriage and whatnot.
For this seemingly perfect marriage and relationship, what were the reasons he gave later for what was it about Nikki that was different than his wife? What was different about this potential relationship that was different than this idyllic one that he had?
Well, I think it's important to understand the dynamic of when he and Shanann first got together, because he, in order to understand what was different for him about Nikki. So when he met Shanann, she wanted nothing to do with him. They were introduced over Facebook by a mutual friend, and he kind of pursued her on Facebook, and she was in a really dark place in her life. She was ill. She was coming off of a divorce, and so she kind of turned him down and said, I'm not really ready to meet anyone. But he kind of kept pushing, and then she agreed to meet him, and they went on a first date. And she still was kind of aloof with him and not really thinking he was her type, but he pursued, he pursued, he pursued. He really went after her. And the dynamic of their relationship from day one was that she was kind of more of the assertive one, kind of wearing the pants in the relationship. She was very much self-admittedly OCD. She really liked things in their order. She really liked control. Everything was meticulous in her house. She was very much a perfectionist, and she did everything really well. And Chris, again, had always had with everybody in his life, it seems, this really quiet, laid back, again, very deferential, very submissive. And he made it seem like he was okay with that dynamic, that he kind of liked being told what to do, that his role was kind of, again, this really good guy who doted on his girlfriend, who then became his wife. And so that was the dynamic that they always had, but that was also the dynamic that Chris sold to her. So if we look at somebody, she's pushing him away and he's convincing her to be with him, he's going above and beyond. In the first few months of dating, he's driving her to colonoscopy appointments. He's rearranging her pills in their pill box, things that are very, very over the top when we're first meeting someone. So he's really trying to sell her something here. And eventually she's like, well, this is the opposite of my first marriage, and this is how, I really like being treated like this. I feel adored. I feel loved. And so, of course, she said, you know what? This is probably what I need in a husband and a father. So the dynamic was there from the beginning. But as many of us who are married or have kids know, that you get married, you have young kids, your life changes. And a lot of the time, little children have lots of needs, and people are busy. They're working, they're trying to put food on the table, they're driving their kids to school. And so their life became they fell into very much of a monotonous, typical, lifestyle of parents with young children. And again, when he met Nicole Kessinger, who he calls Nikki, she was, she's 30. She's single. She, you know, Chris said that he felt that she respected him in a way that nobody else had ever respected him before. I think he felt that she really was interested in what he had to say. And I think he kind of felt over the years, at least this is what he says, is that, you know, I think he felt like he didn't have as much control with Shanann, or maybe didn't feel respected by her, although he never articulated that to her. And so there was never a chance to repair that dynamic if he was unhappy with that. But of course, in the honeymoon phase of a relationship, when you're first meeting somebody, when he's first meeting Nikki Kessinger, you put your best foot forward, and we're not always showing, you know, the worst sides of ourselves as well. So he is sort of looking at the projection fantasy of what he thinks Nikki is. He doesn't really know her. You know, he's been with Shanann for 8 years. Nikki, he's known for, what, a few weeks. And so he's romanticizing and projecting on her as well what I think he wants her to be. But ultimately, I think the big comparison for him was, oh, there's this person, and I feel respected and heard by them, and I haven't felt like that with anyone in my life. And I believe, you know, he did say that, that she was the person he felt respected him the most.
We haven't talked about this LaVey company and also Shanann's success, and also that her friends were all tied up. Some of her best friends were tied up, not tied up, but were also involved in this company and this Thrive. And also what Thrive meant to Chris Watts, because he wasn't always a healthy, fit person growing up. And what did Thrive represent in terms of a supplement and a lifestyle for Chris?
Yeah, so Lavelle is a company, it's a multi-level marketing company that has a product called Thrive, which is some, you know, shakes, supplements. It's supposed to give you energy. They're supposed to be all natural, you know, healthy lifestyle, weight loss. And Shanann, actually, she's always been, you know, she had always been quite an entrepreneur, go-getter. And like a lot of mothers, she wanted to be home with her children and also make money. So something like this appealed to her because she could work from home. And so she actually, because she had her own health issues, she started, I believe, as a customer of this Thrive. And she really liked it, and she started to promote it. And she became, you know, quite successful with these type of things. You know, you make money when you get consultants to work under you, and then you sell the products, and sort of the more people you have working under you, the more money you make. So she was able to use that as her only career. So she was able to quit the other jobs she had had. She had worked, you know, at a call center at a children's hospital before, and had done some other, dabbled in some other type of things. And while she was doing this, she also got Chris to, you know, use the supplements. And part of selling this is using social media. So she and Chris, you know, would be on social media promoting the products. And Chris was quite overweight. You know, they joked, his family joked that he was like a garbage disposal. He would eat everything, you know, loved McDonald's, that kind of thing. And he started eating healthy and working out and taking Thrive, and he dropped a lot of weight, and he started working out and running and weightlifting, and he became, you know, more muscular. He was tan and he was fit, and he was just, I think, overall way more attractive than he had been in the past. And so part of this, you know, was in, it seems like a lot of it was when he started Thrive, and in conjunction with Thrive adopted this healthy lifestyle. And in turn, you know, maybe Nikki Kessinger would not have noticed him before when he was, you know, his sort of overweight self. So that's, it's another interesting thing to look at. Well, all of a sudden he's attractive, you know, by a lot of people would say that, I think, and not now, of course, after what he's done, but before that, you know, he may have been attracting attention from women before. And I think Nikki was the one who pursued him and made him feel sexually desirable. And I'm not sure he's ever had that before in his life. So there was also that attraction of this woman who finds him very sexually attractive. And I think he was very, very much enthralled with somebody who felt like that about him.
Now, you talk about the motivation for this, and there's incredible discussion about the issue of psycho pathology, psychopathy, and also narcissism. And then you discuss subsets of narcissism and narcissistic personality disorder. When people look at someone like Chris, it's easy to say he's a psychopath and very simplistic. Let's talk about the distinction between those, psychopathology and this malignant narcissism.
Yeah, so psychopathology is sort of the study of mental illness, mental disease, and when we're looking at narcissism anyway, those are considered technically by people in the mental health field, our diagnostic manual is personality disorders are, you know, narcissism, but they're not mood disorders. So mood disorders are depression and post-traumatic stress disorder and anxiety. And there's certain medications that people can take that can sometimes help those symptoms. With a personality disorder, you can't take a medication for it. It's sort of fixed in your personality. And so the malignant narcissism it's very parallel to psychopathy. And so there's lots of, you know, debate in the field about psychopathy versus sociopathy versus malignant narcissism, where there's also something called the dark triad, which is traits, you know, like Machiavellianism. But they all sort of share the same thing. And I think that's one of the things that's important to know with sort of when we're looking at malignant narcissism, psychopathy, we're looking at narcissistic personality disorder or the subtypes of narcissism, which I, you know, discuss in the book. Their defining features are lack of empathy and remorse. And so, you know, I think that's the thing that you always want to look for. But malignant narcissism, I think, is when it's really dangerous narcissism. Like this is the worst type of the narcissist. Very psychopathic. Again, they think of people like objects and they will discard you. They will do whatever it takes to just do whatever they want. Like there's just no regard for other human beings. There's a lot of impulsivity. There's a lot of recklessness. They break the law, which again, Chris didn't do any of this, but there's always a first time, right, for every criminal. Mm-hmm. And so sure. He was always capable of it. But again, these perfect storm factors came out later in life, which, you know, I think he's about 35 now, and this happened 2 years ago.
Now let's talk about the influence, basically, of his family, Ronnie, his father, and Cindy, his mother, and his sister, Jamie, and also the relationship they had with Shannon.
Yeah, that's the complicated stuff right there. So Ronnie and Chris I would say Chris would think his father was his hero. You know, we're talking about my book, My Daddy is a Hero. There's a couple father-child relationships where the father is the hero, you know, which is kind of a theme in the book. And Ronnie was Chris's hero. They had a lot in common. They would go to racetracks together. Chris was a really skilled mechanic. He was really into, you know, race cars and things like that. So they would do that together. They were quite bonded. Ronnie would go to Chris's Little League games and, you know, was his big supporter, was at every game. Cindy and Chris's sister Jamie is about 7 years older than he is. And, you know, they had a more distant relationship with Chris. It wasn't a contentious relationship in childhood by any means, but they, which, you know, I get into the book as well, is that they had said that, well, they never knew what he was feeling as a child. You know, he was really closed off and they were always asking him, how are you feeling? Like, nobody really kind of knew what he was thinking or feeling a lot. And so I think, you know, Jamie was the older sister and doted on him. And, you know, his mother, I think, because he was so passive as a child, I think, again, he sort of always let, you know, certain people in his life just kind of dictate things for him. Whether or not he liked that, I don't know. But I think that was a dynamic that started probably with his mother and sister, that he was used to being in relationships with people who kind of just told him what to do, and he kind of just went along with it. Or he was just more of a passive bystander in the relationship. And, you know, nobody kind of really knew what was really going on with him. So as, you know, Shanann was probably his first real girlfriend. I think he'd had maybe like very more casual girlfriends before that, but this was the really serious one. And, you know, he moved in with her, and right away, Shanann clashed, especially with Cindy and Jamie, but she clashed with all three of them. And, you know, as is in the discovery documents of the case and in my book, and you can, you know, find it everywhere on YouTube, that they met for the first time when Shanann had this really nice big house and she had a cookout and they all came. And I think Jamie and Cindy were very skeptical of her to begin with. Like, how does this young woman have such nice things in this big house? And why do you need all that? You know, where Chris came from, I guess, more of a humble background. And Shanann's right. mother, Sandy, also felt there was a cold vibe from them. And again, you know, well, I don't think we'll ever really know the truth behind some of these stories that have happened. Like, there was the famous story about Shanann and Chris's engagement party where Shanann had given Jamie the invitations to be mailed. And right. nobody showed up at the party except, yeah. you know, immediate family. And Shanann believed that Jamie never sent those invitations. I believe Jamie says that she did. So again, you have all these different stories, but the tensions were really high and everything came to a head, you know, when Shanann was in North Carolina the last summer of her life, when the famous incident Nutgate happened, when her children had severe nut allergies, especially the youngest one, Cece, and Chris's mother, Cindy, had allegedly put, you know, something to do with nuts. There's been different stories again. Did the ice cream have nuts, or was there a bowl of nuts on the table? I've heard different mm-hmm. versions of it. But ultimately, Shanann felt that not only was she in front of the girls, but she was also disregarding Shanann's, you know, wanting to protect her children. And it's just really sad, I think, when I think back about some of the texts Shanann had with Chris about that incident, where she's talking about protecting her children at whatever cost and protecting them from evil family, you know, and she's talking about his mother. And she has no idea this whole time that her husband is the one she really needs to protect herself from. I mean, she did need to protect herself from the whole family because it was a very toxic relationship. But it's just really, you know, I still can't get over it. Like, when I think about how Shanann had zero idea her husband was plotting her murder or capable of this, and that also that he would murder her children. Like, she never once thought that she would have to protect herself and her children from her husband. So it's that still kind of shakes me to my core to this day.
Absolutely. Let's just take a second for the break for these messages. Now, you talked about the idea that he could kill his own children. What you have in this book, too, is some horrifying details that I'm not sure everybody's aware of, in terms of the sheer horror of what he had done. Originally, you talk about that he confessed that, and this is where it comes from, and this account is from Chris Watts. Let's talk about what happened when he talks about killing his children, and then afterwards, believing they're dead, he goes to deal with and have this conversation and kill Shanann. What happens this while he's wrapping her up in a bed sheet in the bedroom?
Yeah, so when actually the investigators from the case, both from Colorado Bureau of Investigation and the Frederick Police Department in Colorado, had flown out to his prison in Wisconsin about, you know, several months after he was sentenced to life in prison. And this was one of the confessions that was extracted from him. And this was the first time he had told people, you know, what really happened, and according to him. And, you know, some people also believe he's a very unreliable narrator, which I try to put that in my book, that when I'm talking about what's happening, this is what he's saying, but we also have to keep in mind that he's an unreliable narrator and he's lied and changed his story multiple times. But he, you know, said that he strangled Shanann. And I think it's debatable about, there's some theories that he had drugged her because he had admitted to previously giving her oxycodone to try to get her to miscarry the baby when they were in, when he came out to North Carolina. And, you know, people were a little confused about, oh, it didn't seem like she fought back. I've talked to survivors of domestic violence who have been choked, and some of them will say, you're in shock, you can't fight back. So it's, again, I don't think we really know if she didn't fight back because she couldn't, if she was drugged, if what happened. But I think he waited for her. And after they had had, you know, a contentious discussion about their marriage, I think he had waited for her to drift off to sleep. And then he kind of climbed on top of her and strangled her. And, you know, when he knew she was dead, her body in a sheet, and Bella, who was the 4-year-old, walked into the room and, you know, said, Daddy, what's wrong with Mommy? And he said something, you know, like, Mommy doesn't feel good. And ultimately, I guess Cece woke up as well. And in another confession, he actually has said that he smothered them in their beds with their pillows before Shanana got home from a business trip. So the night she was murdered, she had been away for the weekend. Mm-hmm. And in one of his confessions, he says he smothered them first, but I guess he didn't finish what he had started because he was surprised, you know, that they had woken up. And he says that he was angry that they were still alive. And he also said they looked like they had been traumatized. I think maybe one of them may have had bruises under her eyes or something like that. Yeah. And so they were confused and in disarray. And again, this is just one of several different stories he's told. So I'm just repeating them, but he did drag Shanann's body down the stairs in front of the girls wrapped in a sheet because he couldn't carry her. She was too heavy. And, you know, put her in the car on the bed of the truck in the back, put the girls with their feet dangling over their dead mother, and drove 45 minutes oil field where he worked, where, you know, he then proceeded to strangle Mother Cece with her favorite blanket in front of Bella. And then I believe he put her in the oil tank then, and then he came back to Bella and she said, Daddy, are you going to do the same thing to me that you did to Cece? And he says he doesn't remember what he said. And obviously then he goes and does the same thing and then puts her body in the oil tank. But I mean, you look at, again, I mean, the time, the amount of time, the complete lack of empathy. I'm a mother, and I have a daughter who was born 3 months before Bella was. So when I'm writing this book, I can picture what a girl Bella's age is. It's my own daughter. And there's just nothing in, you know, I get, my voice starts cracking because it's just so upsetting. I'm so upset to this day. There's nothing on this earth that would make a parent who loves their child, who's begging for their life, and to subject them to what he subjected, that type of trauma and what he did to them. It's just, you know, it is pure evil as far as I'm concerned. That is not a human thing to do.
No.
It's still, I can't even go back and read my own book. I cannot read that chapter, but, you know, writing that chapter, I had to disassociate from. It was hard to edit. It's just one of the most incredibly disturbing things I think most of us have ever heard from a father.
Well, and it gets worse because he digs a shallow grave to bury the mother, puts her in face down. She's 15 weeks pregnant. I'm sorry, but what happens? I've never heard of this. And he sees what has happened.
I guess there's a decomposition process where, you know, it's called coffin birth, where the baby is, you know, she's basically given birth after being deceased. And so the baby was, you know, I believe the baby was out as well. And you know, this was the son he had allegedly always wanted. He had pushed for the third child. He really wanted the son. Shanann was so excited to give him a boy. And it was, again, he's like, I don't even care. He did not care about his third child. He did not care he was having a son. Literally zero attachments to his wife, to any of his children. All he wanted was his new life that he had decided was the right thing for him. And he was willing to do anything to get what he wanted.
It's fascinating too that this confession is horrible, but what he does to his own father that he considers a hero. He's in the police station for questioning. There is Detective Baumhofer. There is a CBI agent, Colorado Bureau of Investigation. So these people are speaking with him, and they're suspicious of him immediately. His father goes to this questioning with him. He asks to see his father at some point in the questioning. They allow that. It's one of the most horrifying parts of an incredibly horrifying tale. What does he tell his father about his culpability in this?
Well, you know, one of the things that we have to look at, too, is that when they were trying to extract a confession from him, Tammy Lee was, you know, giving and Graham Coder, the detectives, were proposing different scenarios. You know, they just wanted him to confess to something. They wanted to find the bodies quickly because, you know, the more you wait, the less evidence you have. And so one of the scenarios they had offered him was, they said, did Shanann do something to the girls? Did she do something, you know, and then did you get angry, you know, sort of feeding him those lines. And so when he said he wanted to speak to his father, he said that he had told Shanann that he wanted to leave her, and she got so angry that she strangled the girls. He changed his story. At first he said smothered, and then the father asked, wait, she was choking him or was she smothering him? And he said, oh, choking. So, you know, and he even said he saw them blue in the face, but the baby monitors are black and white. They're not in color. So I don't even know, you know, when I'm thinking about all these details he told, I'm still like, how could you tell that they were blue from the baby monitor? Anyway, this is what he told his father. And by the time he got up there, the girls were dead and he strangled Shanann in a rage. And then he didn't know what to do, was what he said. And that's why he put the bodies in the oil tanks, is that he didn't know what to do. So that also started a wave of, again, you know, people believing that Shanann did it. And, you know, Chris Watts has had his fans. You know, there's people who still believe in his innocence, no matter, you know, what he's said or what he's confessed to. And, you know, so it's pretty shocking just to think about. And I believe his family even, you know, there's different stories I've heard, but, you know, I think there's a part of them that still believe he's innocent or still, you know, are looking. And again, you know, of course, they're probably in such shock and denial. Like, this is not anything they ever expected to happen. But obviously they want to search for any possible answer to make it so that Chris, you know, doesn't have culpability in this. And that you know, was started initially by this false story that he brought to light.
Absolutely. Let's use this as an opportunity to stop, talk about our sponsor, which is FabFitFun. FabFitFun is the only subscription that delivers full-size self-care and wellness products right to your door. They have you covered for every season. Choose from a wide variety of products to customize your very own box, or be surprised if you want, and the FabFitFun team will create a selection of products just for you. There are even flash sales throughout the year, which with products up to 70% off their retail price. My wife Lisa has been receiving FabFitFun boxes for 3 years now, and she seemed as excited as ever to receive her winter FabFitFun box. She was excited to get her Summer and Rose cozy robe. Incredibly soft, stylish, it fit perfect. She was also anxious to try the Daily Facial Day Brush, Dry Brush from Daily Concepts for daily radiant skin. Lisa told me she loved the product and now adding it to her daily regimen. She was also very impressed with the Caudalie Venosource Moisturizing Sorbet. They say a must-have for sensitive skin. Lisa wholeheartedly agrees. FabFitFun has enabled Lisa to try the latest and greatest new brands of self-care and wellness products in the world today, pampering Lisa with all their amazing products. And she tells everyone what an amazing bargain FabFitFun really is. Sign up for just $49.99 and get 8 to 10 products valued at over $200. Order your winter box today. Sign up now so you can snag amazing products like the Cozy Robe and Moisturizing Sorbet when you customize. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. That's use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at fabfitfun.com. Now, Lena, we were speaking about this incredible case. Eventually, he is pressured to avoid a death penalty, but also there are other reasons. Tell us why you think that it was that he agreed to a plea deal in this case.
I think there were several reasons. Again, you know, looking at what I believe is his narcissism, and, you know, I describe this subtype, what's called communal narcissism, which I believe fits the profile of Chris. To understand how these narcissistic people operate is they are constantly looking for something called narcissistic supply, which is attention, admiration, anything that makes them feel special. They're addicted to it. They'll do anything to get it. Someone who's a communal narcissist uses good deeds or the persona of being helpful and trustworthy to get that narcissistic supply. And so, you know, people always think, well, if people are psychopaths or, you know, narcissists, they don't care what other people think. But actually, narcissistic people very much care about what other people think about them. In fact, it's central to sort of the way they operate. They need other people to admire them. And Chris really needed that. You know, he really needed people to see him in a good light. And even, you know, after his wife is missing and he's texting with her friends, he's even saying things to them like, oh, I don't want you to think I'm a bad person. And so I also think that there's a part of the motivation and the crime of, you know, people say, well, why didn't he get a divorce? I think there was multiple reasons why he didn't do that in his twisted mind. That's not a normal mind. So normal people don't think like that. Which I think was interesting when I was studying psychopathy. You know, they'll say that psychopathic people, when they think about solutions to their problems, they think about antisocial solutions. So in that would be murder, for example. Whereas people who are not psychopathic, like Shanann, for example, will think of pro-social solutions to their problems, which is what she did when she started noticing trouble in her marriage a few weeks before she was killed. She was sending him self-help books. She wanted to go to counseling. She was looking at herself. She was saying, what can I change to make things better? But that's a pro-social solution to a problem. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's something to understand too. So in Chris's mind, he's thinking of these antisocial solutions, but I also believe that what would it look like to Chris if he divorced his pregnant wife and left pregnant wife, you know, his wife with three children, and it came out that he had a new woman, like it would make him look really bad. And I think he wanted to avoid that at all costs. And so, again, part of that motivation, I think he just wanted to be rid of them and just didn't want any baggage. But I also think, you know, he could also set himself up to look like the victim. You know, oh, my wife, I think he wanted to make it appear like she left him, and that he didn't have enough time to set it up that way. But there were certain things he did and said that alluded to the fact that, you know, oh, we had a fight, and to spite me, she took the kids and she left me. So then he could be this victim and that people could feel sorry for Chris. And so I think that was really, really important to him, that people saw him in a good light. And so I think the confession, the early confession, was one to he's still playing the role of the good boy that he always was, you know, that he's the people pleaser. He's doing the right thing. But also, I believe he wanted to avoid a trial. I don't think any of us expected that we would get a public dump of the documents, which, you know, became public record. And everything came out anyway. And the sentencing was televised, and the prosecutor, he outlined exactly what had happened as well. And, you know, he made look like a horrible person, even in, you know, the short speech that he gave, just talking about the affair with Nikki. And while his wife is begging him to talk to her, he's researching jewelry and Victoria's Secret for Nikki. And, you know, just he's already totally forgotten about his wife. So Yeah, I believe that he wanted to avoid a trial. He wanted to avoid being dragged through the mud. And I also think, yeah, he wanted to just maintain the appearance that he saved everybody from the trouble of a trial.
Sure. You spoke and consulted with Kim Gorgon's psychologist, and she talks about her concept of a failed psychopath. But can we talk about your idea that people might wonder why somebody seemingly so intelligent and organized to a great degree, and with this great evidence of a lot of premeditation into these murders, why somebody so smart could do something so stupid?
Yeah, and I mean, I guess there's different types of smart and intelligence, right? So we know that Chris had zero emotional intelligence. We know that. They did describe him as sort of a Rain Man type. Like, in certain ways, he was a genius. He could recall facts. You know, his grandmother, when he was a child, would test him in all the state capitals while they would wait for his sister to come out of school, and he would get them all right. He was great with cars. He was, you know, he had this memory that was incredible. So he had a certain amount of intelligence. But the other thing, again, with to me, the failed psychopath was just an aha moment when Dr. Gorgon said that to me. And I'll have to get back to that in a minute. But again, when somebody is really narcissistic, they do not think that they think they're the smartest person in the world, and they think they can get away with anything. So Chris thinks he's really convincing. He actually believed that he could create this scenario and people would believe it. I think he really thought that he could convince people that Shanann took off to spite him. And so, you know, he made all these mistakes. He didn't even think about the GPS tracking in his truck, which, you know, law enforcement was going to find. Obviously, he probably doesn't watch a lot of CSI or crime shows when, you know, the husband is always suspect number one, no matter what. Like, his narcissism, I think, was so off the charts that he just believed that he could convince people of anything. And that, I think, was his stupidity and his downfall, was his narcissism. He doesn't understand the perspective of other people. He doesn't give other people enough credit.
Now, with that idea as well, is that the difference between this, again, the failed psychopath, what exactly was his, once he was in prison, we talked about it in the introduction, what was his attitude and about culpability? And what was his response from his own family after they realized that, despite their support, that he really was most likely guilty completely?
Yeah, and again, I think his family goes back and forth about, I don't know, I don't speak to them, I don't know them. But just again, from, you know, things I may have heard, I don't know what they think now. But he in prison he's shown no real remorse. You know, everything is him feeling sorry for himself. It's all about, you know, I hear he's still, you know, trying to think of ways to get out of prison. One of those things, you know, he's all of a sudden a reformed man of God, and he wants to get out and proselytize to people and help people and, you know, all of these things. But he's never really shed any real tears. He's never talked about how he misses his children or any qualities about them. I've done several interviews, and this is one of the things that I always share because it stuck out to me so much, is when he was talking about his girls in the interrogations when he knew they were dead, and he was conjuring up memories of them. And the only thing he could think of to say about them was, like, he missed them throwing chicken nuggets at him. I was like, wow, that's a really interesting, really cold, removed thing to say when your children are missing. And he almost said it with this disdain for them too. And he even goes on to say that, he says, sometimes they're bossy, like they're, and he's about to say mother, and he stops himself. He actually realizes that the images he has of his own children are them pelting chicken nuggets of them or being bossy. This is what he thinks. He can't even say anything human about them when they're missing. Like, there's nothing genuine he can say about them. And even now, you know, he's saying, oh, I'm looking out the window and I could have a 1-year-old, a
5-year-old and, you know, what, however old they would be at the time. But he's like, but now it's just me. And that's him feeling sorry for himself. And that's all I've heard from him is just constant pity for himself. And I, you know, his parents still, you know, tell them how much they love him and they stand by him. And I'm not here to put a judgment on that. You know, other people have their different opinions on that. But that is, I think, an insight into how he's never really taken any culpability or accountability for anything. And I don't think his, you know, his family has never really held him accountable either. So it kind of makes sense when you look at it that way.
You mentioned Sherilyn Cadle's book and the confession. Just tell us briefly about how she was able to do this and who she is, and just tell us a little bit about this book.
Yeah, that's a whole mess. You know, her book came out in October of 2019 and mine came out in the first week of December. And shortly after she published it, there was some scandal around plagiarism, which I had not known about, you know, when my book was published, but she had plagiarized excerpts from another true crime author. So it wasn't plagiarism around Chris Watts, but it was just her own writing. So that book ended up being pulled off the shelves because she literally plagiarized. The author's name is Anne Howard, I believe. And that information is all out there if anybody wants to, you know, Google. But she approached Chris. Apparently, I heard she has a second book coming out too, like a follow-up of this. But apparently she had approached Chris in prison as a you know, religious woman and telling him she wanted to write a story about his path to redemption. So making it out to be like this was going to be more of like a religious finding God book, a redemption for him.
Sure.
And she went and met with him in person. She several times had driven there and, you know, she has described when he talks about the murders, his eyes going dark. Like, I think she got some really dark, bad energy from him. And I think, you know, maybe as she sat with him and spoke with him, maybe she started to really dislike him. You know, that's the impression sort of that I get, that she 100% believes he's guilty, but he had written her letters and in person was the one who had, you know, this was the first time he had confessed to certain things like giving Shanann the oxy to Miss Carrie. He had mentioned to Sherilyn Cadle and some of her letters the Daily Mail published as an exclusive. So they're also out there on the internet. But, you know, I think that particular letter in the Daily Mail that they had printed was one where he is like, after I buried them and put them in oil tanks, I drove away and I felt no remorse. All I could think about was, had the dog eaten yet? Like, he would make those kind of comments.
Right.
And, you know, I don't think any of those actual letters have been disputed by anybody. I do believe that those letters, you know, are very much in his handwriting and very much a reflection of who he is. But yeah, the entire thing around that book, unfortunately, is just a big mess.
You cite Dr. Douglas Fields that you consulted with, a neuroscientist and author of Why We Snap, A Rage Circuit in the Brain, regarding and snapping, the concept of snapping. Can you discuss what he feels, how this would relate, or you feel this would relate to this case? Can you discuss that?
Yeah, it was really important to me to also look at neuroscience and snapping because everybody wondered too, was this a nice guy who snapped? So I thought, well, what does it mean to snap? I mean, we know there's a show about it, right? There's Snapped. And when we think of snapped, we think in a second, somebody goes into a rage and does something and regrets it. But Dr. Fields, you know, studies the brain. And in his work, he identified that in humans and, you know, in animals, there are about 9 circuits in the brain that when stimulated or triggered, prompts us to go into a violent rage. And so he identified what those 9 triggers are. And, you know, some of them are pretty obvious. One he calls, he has like a sort of acronym for it called life morphs, and the L stands for life or limb. And so that means, of course, when you're threatened, it's like self-defense, right? The self-defense reasoning. When you feel like you're going to be threatened physically, like bodily harm or murder, you don't even think about it, right? You go into a rage. Mm-hmm. But there's other things too. And, you know, one of the things that I found really interesting from talking with him was called the S trigger, which he says stands for stopped. So whenever anybody feels like they are impeded from doing something, mm-hmm. that can be stopped. So, you know, he explained it to me as like when you're in traffic and road rage comes up, you feel like you're being stopped from going somewhere. And this is because these pathways that we have in our brain, these neural pathways, are primitive. They're, you know, they've evolutionary for us. They haven't mm-hmm. fully adapted. And so even though the logic in us knows like, oh, we're just in traffic. It's okay. We're going to get to where we're going to be. The primitive response in the brain is like a real threat. And so that's why sometimes you have people who do really crazy things with road rage. And one of the other things he mentioned to me is that snapping is what he defines as a break from reality, which, again, it doesn't mean that someone is not accountable for their actions. And I really think it's important that he says that, and I say that as well,
right.
that we
sure.
are all fully accountable for our actions. But what I did find interesting was that he said this process of snapping can go on for weeks or even months. And I had read some other FBI profilers that talked about this as well, that people think snapping is just in an instance. But this break from reality is like something that also allows people for weeks or months to plot something like murder. Again, when people are like, how is he so stupid? There's also this response from him that's a real break from reality where he's not seeing clearly. He just wants to get what he wants. Mm-hmm. And Dr. Fields doesn't do anything with personality disorders or anything like that, but he does get letters from people in prison all the time who are thanking him. They've read his book and they say, thank you for helping me understand. He thinks though with a lot of people who snap, they end up having remorse for it. And that's where I think, you know, I diverged by saying, well, there's people who absolutely do not have remorse. And we can see that, you know, with I'm sure many of the criminals you've covered, in
sure.
your podcast, in your work. So we know that there's a spectrum of good and evil, and all people fall somewhere, you know, on that spectrum. And there are, unfortunately, a rare subset of people who have absolutely no remorse. And so I think it's possible for all of those things to exist together, which again goes back to the perfect storm of factors in my book, is I think you can be a psychopathic, narcissistic person, be, you know, have that S trigger where he felt he was stopped from getting the life he wanted. And his anger was then in turn projected onto his wife and children, who he believed were the barrier for him to get what he wanted. And then he turned to his antisocial solution and thought it was a good idea for him to get what he wanted.
When he texted Nikki Nikki Kessinger, that his family was gone, later, when he discussed the case and his guilt with her, he acted like, oh, will this be a deal breaker? I'm not using exact words. Can you discuss his seem to be oblivious about that and his statement to her?
Yeah, I really think he felt like, okay, got rid of my family. You know, after he killed them, you know, it's also in the book that he called the girls' school. It was a daycare. And he told them that they weren't going to be coming back anymore. This is hours after he killed them. He calls the school and says, oh, they're not going to be coming back anymore. Then he proceeds to call his real estate agent and says, oh, we're putting the house on the market. Let's get it going. So he's already like, I've killed my family. I'm done. I'm ready to start my new life, putting my house on the market, unenrolling my children from school, and then texting her and saying, like, my family's gone. He responded to an email about fantasy football saying he was in. Like, he was all ready to just go forward with his life. And if he had gotten away with this, you know, I believe that he would have never had any remorse about it. And yeah, he just expected that, you know, Nikki was going to be like, oh, okay. I think he just expected that everyone was going to be like, okay, they're gone now. That's, oh, well, you know, and Nikki was going to be like, great. Okay. You don't have a family anymore. Let's all, it was just a very delusional state of mind. But again, it's just a reflection of how, again, these really narcissistic people operate. They don't think like normal people. They actually think that that's an acceptable response when your children are missing. And they can't understand that other people are scratching their heads saying, what's wrong with you? This is weird. This is not how you respond when your family's missing.
Yeah, and his response, too, that he said that one of the reasons for killing Shanann was that she said, you will never see your kids again if you leave. So,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very interesting.
Yeah. And we don't know if she said that either. You know, again, that's what he says. You know, a lot of people have pointed out that, you know, he says, oh, I got angry when she said you'll never see your kids again. So then you killed your children? So you would ensure that you would never see them again? You know, there's just that. There's a lot of discrepancies to what he's said. And I don't think, you know, we're never going to know the full truth.
What's interesting, too, is I mentioned it before earlier, was the neighbor named Nate and also mm-hmm. Nikki Atkinson and their role. But what's one of the most fascinating, I guess, vivid cinematic scenes in your book is Nate and some of the friends initially. Tell us about Nate and his video footage and the scene where he puts it on the television set in front of Chris and some of Shanann's friends.
Yeah, this is crazy because, you know, when Nikki Atkinson, who's one of Shanann's best friends, within hours, she had dropped Shanann at her home at 2 a.m. and literally by 9 a.m. knew something was wrong and, you know, mm-hmm. had called the police to do a wellness check in the afternoon. And while the Officer Coonrod, who was the one who responded to the scene, well, he was, you know, going around and looking, Nate Trinistich, their next door neighbor, came by and he said, you know, I have a security camera that faces the front of their house and I have some footage and you guys should come over and watch it. And so Nate, you know, they all go to Nate's house and he turns on the footage on the TV and you can see Chris standing next to it, his hands on his head, he's rocking back and forth. This is the only time you see real emotion from him. You know, he looks really scared. And, you know, I think in my book, too, I had cited a research study that showed that psychopaths do feel fear. So there is some misconception that psychopathic people don't feel anything, but they actually do feel fear and anxiety. And so, again, that's when he shows emotion, is when he thinks he's going to get caught because he knows that he loaded Shanann's body into the truck and brought the girls out. And, you know, you can't see too much in that video footage. You can see him walking back and forth, but you can't really see what he's doing. And there have been multiple videos that have zeroed in and analyzed that security footage over and over again. And there's some footage, you know, where you can see, like, the shadows of the girls and him kind of picking them up and putting them in the truck. And the prosecution has verified that that was the case, that that actually did happen. And so... So they kind of knew, you know, you can kind of know that the girls were alive at that point based mm-hmm. on that. But, yeah, I mean, it's really interesting that he's really worried he's going to get caught. And Nate Trinistich, who doesn't know him, he wasn't friends with Shanann and Chris. He was just their neighbor. But as soon as mm-hmm. Chris leaves, he turns there and he's like, this isn't right. This guy is acting weird. And he kind of knows. It's almost like everybody, even Shanann's mother, right away, even though they mm-hmm. never would have pegged him for it before, it's like this gut feeling that everybody had about him, that something was just really, really wrong with his behavior. And, yeah, that was a really wild moment, that security footage.
Let's talk about this. Again, it's amazing to me, after all of these years, that this comes up so much, this element that for many people, and I guess nonfiction would say, well, that's a bit much. Tell us about the supernatural experience that Sandy has, witnessed by her husband.
Yeah, she had said on Dr. Phil, so, you know, I have kind of researched all different interviews from different places, and on Dr. Phil, she was woken up, you know, in the middle of the night, and she felt this presence of some, you know, Shanann, or she heard some voice, and she... It was around 4 a.m, which could have been around the time Shanann was killed. And at that moment, she believed that something was wrong with Shanann. She woke up her husband and her son, Frankie Jr., and she was really worried. And she said, something's wrong with Shanann. And they were kind of like, no, it's all right. You know, you're just having a bad dream. It's fine. Go back to sleep. But yeah, again, this there's a real, a sense of a real powerful mother-daughter connection where it was almost like she, the mother was experiencing what was happening to Shanann and, you know, it woke her up. And so I think that that was a really another powerful, there's so many powerful relationships, you know, just thinking about Sandy and Shanann and that moment and the love that Nikki had for her friend Shanann where, you know, she didn't have to call the police for a wellness check, but it's like she just acted on her instincts and she went right away for it. And, you know, again, we have a lot of credit to her because without her, who knows how, you know, if how much Chris would have been able to cover up his tracks. Without her, you know, we may not have had Shanann's cell phone, which he had hid in the cushions, but somebody had found it, you know, because he didn't have time to clean up his tracks. They were able to find her. Everything was left at home, her purse, her medication, her phone, the car and the car seats were there. So he really had no way out at that point because he had no time to dispose of anything. And I credit that to Nikki, Shanann's best friend.
Yeah, absolutely. It's interesting, very much like the Bernard or Homolko case, when the police do come, and of course in that case they didn't expect the police to be there so soon, there's just like in this case, Chris is washing his daughter's clothes. Washer and dryer going when they do get to the home. And the police officer comes upstairs, and what does he notice about the beds? Again, making him immediately suspicious, given, again, this pressure where Chris didn't anticipate the police being in the house that quick at all.
Yeah, the master bed, you know, had its sheets stripped, and they had found some of one of the sheets in the garbage can at the house, and the other sheet was found at the burial site of Shanann, and they had found that with the drone. And so, yeah, he didn't have time. I mean, it's very suspicious, you know, that they're going to find sheets with mascara stains and things of that nature in the trash can. So he was obviously trying to dispose of evidence, and again, he wasn't very smart. He had also disposed of the book that she had, self-help book she had sent him, called Hold Me Tight, Seven Conversations for a Lifetime of Love. And he hadn't even opened it out of the Amazon box. He literally sort of, or he had opened the box or something, but the book was still in the box and he had just thrown it into the trash. And so when the investigators were going through everything, they find the sheets in the trash, they find the self-help book, you know, it was like everything was just so discarded by him. It was like done. And he had left behind so much evidence, even, you know, it wasn't all forensic evidence, but all of it together really painted a picture of the disregard he had for his family.
Now we mentioned now that he's in prison, and you write that he finds God and believes about his mission in life, but also, he has fan mail, letters. So what is his position now about these murders once he's in prison? And what does he, again, I just mentioned, what does he think his mission is now?
Yeah, his mission, I think, well, it may have changed by now, but last I heard, you know, he's wanting to help people through the Bible. I heard with another inmate, they're potentially writing something religious together. You know, he's really, again, I think using it though as an angle. Like, I think again, for his entirety of his life, he's used this good boy, helpful image, and that's gotten him out of trouble. And I really think that part of him thinks like, oh, if I just act really good, they're going to let me out. But it's almost like he's totally ignorant of the fact that he has life sentences for killing three people, an unborn child, tampering with human body, you know, with bodies, things. There's so many charges against him that it's like hundreds of years, you know, of like, you don't just get out on good behavior when you do those kind of crimes. But I really believe that he thinks, again, his narcissism, that he's going to convince everybody that he's this man of God. And he does. He gets lots of letters. He corresponds with women. Some of them visit him in prison and talk to him. You know, in the narcissism world, we have a term called flying monkeys, which is the people around the narcissist that sort of do their bidding for them and pass on their messages. And, you know, that could be the case here, is that he has all these he does have some people around him where he can, where then they can talk to the press or People magazine and, you know, say whatever they want to say, that he's a changed man or that, or, you know, just pass messages from him that he wants the public to hear. I did hear he was upset about the Netflix documentary that came out because it painted him in a bad light. Again, you know, it's funny because I hired an attorney for this book because, you know, I'm a psychotherapist. There's ethics involved. I really wanted to make sure that this book was ethical, legally and otherwise and professionally. And I just really wanted to do my best with it. And, you know, I say really the only person that I really talk about in a negative light is Chris Watts. And my attorney told me a funny story that someone in prison who was a murderer as well had written him and was upset that there was a book about him. And he was, you know, talking about libel and all this stuff. And my attorney had written back to that prisoner and said, sorry, you already ruined your reputation when you killed people. And so, you know, there's this idea that like there's just nothing, you've already done this to your reputation, there's nothing you can do to redeem yourself, you know, but these people will keep trying. They really, again, they can't see what the rest of us are seeing because they don't have empathy. They can't put themselves in someone else's shoes.
You also talk about, I mean, the phenomena of someone, Shanann, and also other people, the family, people in the family, that didn't see the con, that were duped. And so you talk about it's impossible to avoid being duped. Why do you think that? Tell us, discuss that a little bit. Why you don't think you would think it's impossible to avoid being fooled?
Yeah, you know, I spoke to a journalist who wrote a book called Duped, where she had been duped by a con man. Her name's Abby Ellen, and she wrote about her experience about it and the psychology of being duped. And she's a friend of a friend, so I had actually interviewed her for the book as well. And she's like, you know, even the smartest people get duped because we don't think we're going to be duped, but there's also this human side of us that believe the best in people. And I think also, if we're generally good people, a lot of us have a bias that other people are going to act in the same ways we do. And I think a lot of us just believe the best in people. But I think Chris was an exceptional con man in the sense that I really don't believe anybody that knew him or was involved with this, anybody could have ever predicted this. That's what a good con man he was. And, you know, in the book, I talk about how psychopaths, and I even cite the experience of a self-described psychopath, about how they spend a lifetime crafting a mask that they portray to the world. And I think Chris had spent a lifetime mimicking people and creating this mask that he put on. And psychopaths can create really convincing masks, and that's the scary part. But again, he had, you know, I don't even think he ever really... if he had raised his voice with people, it had been on a very rare occasion. He had showed no signs of violence or anything. Again, all his behavior had just been, you know, doting father and husband up until he met Nikki Kessinger. Apparently, you know, even Shanann was shocked. She felt that the carpet had been pulled out from under her because she had, you know, in private text messages to friends said, we have never had problems like this in our marriage. This is out of the blue. I don't know what happened. So here she is for, you know, up until she left for the summer vacation, she's thinking she has this great marriage. They're physically affectionate. You know, they have a good sexual relationship. They're loving, they're playful. They have, you know, she thinks that she's got it all. And I really believe she felt that way. And I think, again, one of the chilling moments that, you know, I will never be able to shake is, we have the footage of the last moment, one of the last moments of her life, when Nikki Atkinson drops her off at her house at, you know, around 2 a.m. And we have the security camera, the doorbell camera footage from her house. And, you know, she's walking into her house. And, you know, we all know now that she is walking into her death. And at that point, Chris has probably already attempted at smothering the daughters. And she has no idea what she's walking into. And that is, and nobody had an idea. If somebody had, she never would have walked into that house. She never would have left her children there. Nobody would have ever allowed this to happen. And so, again, I think that just shows the how he was really able to dupe and con people. And again, you know, it goes back to the failed psychopath thing where Dr. Gorgons, who told me about community psychopaths, which is what she did her dissertation on. And, you know, she said to me, Lena, we only study the psychopaths who are in jail, and we call them the failed psychopaths because they're not very good at what they do. And so that's why I said, you know, there's a first time for every criminal. Chris's first time was killing his family that we know of. Who knows? You know, maybe there was other things. We'll never know. But, you know, as far as we can tell, I think the most likely scenario was this really was. He probably didn't even really have a speeding ticket before. You know, this is truly his first real crime. But she says, you know, there's a whole world of psychopaths that never get caught, that are never in prison. And those are the successful psychopaths. And so I think when she put it like that, it's really easy to see that he actually just failed at what he did. He was probably a psychopath all along, and he just eventually failed at it, and that's why he's in prison now.
Tell us the reason for the book being called Daddy is a Hero. Tell us about this incident.
Well, you know, there was the title to this day is still the – I still struggle with that. I couldn't think of a title. What we wanted to portray, which was me and my editor mostly, was the idea, again, of the con man, of the the other book about this case by John Glass called The Perfect Father, for example. So I think that's the thing that sticks out for everybody about this case and the obsession with it is, again, Bella, his daughter. So a few months before he killed the family, Shanann had taken a video of her where she was singing this song called My Daddy is a Hero. And every chapter in the book, for the most part, especially the storytelling part of the book where you're going through the events as if it's in real time, every chapter has a quote from somebody that's sort of about the irony of Chris's double life, like what he portrayed to the world versus who he really was. And so, you know, one of the chapters headings could be, I couldn't have asked for a better man, which is what Shanann said. You know, so they sort of all have that. A theme to it about his psychopathy and narcissism and how he was able to fool everybody. And so I think My Daddy is a Hero was the ultimate con in a way, but it also, I think it really, you know, it again goes to, these were real people. He killed his children. He killed his children who called him a hero. Like this, I think it really encompasses the true severity of what he did and that, you know, how evil it was. And so I wanted that to really be to come across. And I mean, it's chilling and it's jarring. And then again, there's other aspects again. Chris's father was his hero. So, you know, you could interpret it as, you know, there's different father heroes in this story. And it's sort of all again about the mirage of how scary it is that people can pretend to be something they're not and fool everybody.
I know this sounds almost like a cliche about, you know, warning signs, something that might be seen so that we might possibly prevent something like this in the future. But were there warning signs? Were they subtle? What were the warnings, if any? Were there
warning
signs?
Yeah, I mean, the warning signs were not warning signs where you would say, okay, this person's going to kill me, warning signs, which again is, like I said, there's absolutely no way anybody would have predicted this or been able to stop this. But again, I wanted to make something good come out of this. Again, I did not want this to be sensational. I wanted people to maybe learn something. I really got very touched when I get, you know, letters from people that said, thank you for putting this information out there. This could have been me. I got out. I want other people to read this book so they know. Because sometimes people are in these relationships and there are more obvious signs that are there. And, you know, it's nice to hear that people could use this book to identify those signs. And even if they're not in danger of being murdered, maybe it will make them look at their relationships or put up boundaries where they need to put them up. But one of the bigger signs I tell people, and again, this doesn't mean someone's going to, this is not a sign of someone who's going to murder you.
Right.
But narcissistic and psychopathic people have a pattern in relationships, which is referred to as love bombing, devalue, and discard. And so actually you can, you know, I sort of illustrate how that happened with Chris and Shanann, where in the beginning he love bombed her. It's in the beginning of this interview, we talked about him really pursuing her and going over the top to win her over.
Yep.
So with narcissistic people, they're, again, they're really trying to win you over. They go really over the top. They may not even know you well. They may know you for 2 days and say, I want to spend the rest of my life with you. That doesn't mean that someone is a narcissist if they do that, by the way, but that is, that can be a red flag if somebody doesn't really know you well and they seem to have this agenda to really win you over. So that's called love bombing. But when you know you're kind of dealing with a person, you know, someone with more of a personality disorder, once they win you over, they shift to something called devalue. And so in Chris's case, which I think is more rare, because I think usually in these situations, at least in the ones I've encountered personally and in my professional life, the devalue phase comes pretty quickly. And that's when they become very, a lot of the times, emotionally abusive, although it can also be other forms of abuse. And that can be, look like criticizing or, you know, when you know something's wrong or mistreating you. So Chris began to devalue Shanann much later on when he met Nikki. In the beginning, the first few weeks, he was playing along with Shanann while he was having an affair with Nikki. He's still telling Shanann he loves her to the moon and back and, you know, playing a game.
Mm-hmm.
But then when he really decides he wants to be rid of his family, this is when Shanann starts getting really upset because all of a sudden her husband turns on her. So after being together 8 years and having a third kid on the way, all of a sudden her husband doesn't want the third baby, wants the separation, doesn't want to work things out. And so I said, this is a real red flag. Like when you're with somebody and you have children with them and they turn on you with no explanation on the drop of a hat, there's something wrong there. That's not a person who has real attachments or emotional maturity or commitment or investment to you. That's not normal for somebody to just flip like that. And so, again, I don't think that was predictive of him going to murder her, but I think it was a sign and it was true that other things were going on. I mean, he flipped because he was, he was having an affair and he didn't want anything to do with her anymore. But that's the thing with narcissistic people. When they don't need you anymore, you're like garbage to them. And they only keep people around that, again, fuel their narcissistic supply or serve them in some way. So for Chris, his family could have given him admiration, could have made him look good to the outside world. Like he needed them for something until he didn't. And that's when the discard phase comes in. And that's basically, like I said, with Chris Watts, it was the ultimate discard. Discard we usually refer to as like they leave you and then they don't want anything to do with you again, or they act like you never mattered. Literally discarded his family like garbage. Like, I'm done with you. That's it. You're not human to me. And so, again, that's when we're going really to the malignant side of narcissism, the real severe side of psychopathy, because the empathy is just pretty much non-existent, zero. It's so self-focused on the gratification of his own needs at the expense of everybody else. And so that's what I would say about all of that.
Yeah, he certainly did dispose of these people. He certainly discarded them, and in a spectacular, horrible fashion. I want to thank you so much for coming on and talking about your book, My Daddy's a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer. You are a clinical instructor in the Department of Psychology and Behavioral Sciences at the George Washington School of Medicine, mentoring medical students. And tell us about you're a co-host of a psychology podcast. Tell us about what that podcast is and if there's a website for this or Facebook page for this book.
God bless. I hate social media. One of my close friends is a marketer, and she kind of looks at my Facebook page every now and then, which is lenaderhali.com. That's my website, and there's also a Facebook page, Lena Derhali. My podcast, because of the pandemic, we really, my colleague Bob and I, who have done that together, we really haven't updated it much, but, you know, we sort of get together as couple therapists. He's a male therapist, I'm a female therapist, and we talk about all kinds of just issues that our clients are experiencing, and we do a lot of relational issues and couples issues and anxiety. And we do have it's sessions with Bob and Lena. But yeah, we just kind of, we do that as inspired when we think there's something out there we could talk about that could help other people.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. My Daddy is a Hero, How Chris Watts Went from Family Man to Family Killer. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Lena Durhalley.
Thank you, Dan. It's been great speaking with you today.
Thank you. You have a great evening. Good night.
You too. Okay. Bye-bye.
Good night.